at dosamigos.com. This is NHPR.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and here are some of the voices from the top Granite State stories this week.
The reality is when the government shows up and says, hi, we have a solution for you to this problem, and we're going to fund it, you should panic.
If they are delayed a few weeks because they couldn't get online, yes. But, I'm not for delaying the individual mandate for a year or anything like that, just kind of extending the enrollment period for a few weeks.
We've spent an awful lot of money towards education. It's time now that we look at what we're using this money for, as we do need to raise the bar in education throughout this country and this state.
Burton's a politician who's omnipresent in the communities he serves and who actually seems to love dealing with people. When a constituent approaches Burton with a problem, his characteristic move is to take an index card from his coat pocket, jot down the particulars, and then see what he can do.
We're going to win it. This is the year. This is our city. In the past 6 months, the city and the surrounding cities have gone through a lot of trauma, okay? And this is exactly the thing that we need to bring it back, for sure.
It hasn't happened at Fenway Park for 95 years. The Red Sox are world champions.
From the top, that was Republican State Senator George Lambert at an anti-Medicaid expansion news conference. Democratic Congresswoman Carol Shea Porter on the continued mishaps of healthcare.gov. Republican State Lawmaker Rick Ladd talking about the new Common Core school standards. NHPR's Josh Rogers on Executive Counselor Ray Burton, who announced he'll step aside next year. And sounds from the Fenway faithful and the World Series. Besides Red Sox mania, political comings and goings were big news in the Granite State this week, including rising speculation as to whether former Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown will make another run for the U.S. Senate, this time from the Granite State. He's got a vacation home here, is selling his Bay State residence, and this week launched a New Hampshire Political Action Committee. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you. We want your thoughts about the headlines of the week. Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. Our guests for this week's roundup are Kevin Landrigan, political reporter for the Telegraph of Nashua. Kevin, welcome back. Great to see you as always.
Thanks, Laura.
Also with us, Jeff Maccheroni. He's a staff writer at the Hippo Press. And Jeff, welcome to the roundtable, and thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website, nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, thank you for being here as well. I always appreciate it.
Hi, good morning, Laura.
Well, and Dean, I'm going to make your day and start with a political story. And let's talk about Scott Brown. There's been a lot of murmurings about the former U.S. senator, whether he'll run for U.S. Senate from New Hampshire this time. He set up a New Hampshire Political Action Committee this week called the People's PAC. Now, what's that all about, Dean?
Well, as we know, Scott Brown has been, ever since he lost his Senate seat to Elizabeth Warren, he's been traveling around the country a little bit. He's been in Iowa. He's been in New Hampshire. There's been speculation about potential presidential ambitions, potential senatorial ambitions, and a race against Gene Shaheen. So now he has set up a political action committee, a PAC, in New Hampshire. As you mentioned, it's called the People's Seat. Now, this is a reference to, if you remember back when he ran the remainder of Ted Kennedy's seat, people kept referring to it as Ted Kennedy's seat, and he said it's not Ted Kennedy's seat, it's the people's seat. So that's kind of his name, and it matches up with his national PAC as well. It basically gives him an opportunity to basically give money to different candidates in New Hampshire at all levels. So it's an opportunity to get involved in New Hampshire politics. It's hard to read what his intentions are. He clearly enjoyed being a U.S. senator. He's been sort of figuring out a way to get back ever since. And so this kind of move gets him a lot of attention. And so, it's interesting. We're kind of in a political media culture now in which if you've been a former national office holder and you even kind of sort of talk or visit a particular place, then there's all the speculation. So it's a way to kind of keep himself I think, relevant and potentially viable. I don't know that he's going to run for Senate. You know, the field in New Hampshire is only taking shape now. We really don't have a particularly strong field. So it might be an opportunity.
The Republican field.
Right. We have Karen Testerman and Jim Rubens who have gotten in so far. So it's a potential opportunity. I think if he's going to do this and he waits much longer, he's going to run into an even bigger kind of sort of carpetbagger problem. The PAC has a Massachusetts address, but he has a sister in the state who's the treasurer, and he also owns a property in the state as well. So he could technically run. So it's getting a lot of coverage. I'm not sure what it means, but again, he seems to figure out a way to kind of keep himself visible regardless of what he's actually going to do.
Well, and Kevin Landigan, just to remind us, I mean, even though Scott Brown lost re-election in 2012, he was only in for 2 years. He made quite an impact on national politics in a short period of time. Just remind us how he made such a big impact at that particular moment.
Well, as Dean pointed out, I mean, he took over a seat that was held by certainly by a political icon, Ted Kennedy. So there were pretty big shoes to fill there. Scott Brown certainly, since he has left office, has kind of characterized himself as a commentator with Fox News and others in a fairly conservative vein. But when he was in the Senate, he was very much of a unpredictable new member. The Republican caucus, the conservatives in the Senate were very frustrated with him at times, with his refusal to commit to some of their agenda and sometimes going along with President Obama's agenda.
And he would say, hey, I'm a Massachusetts Republican, and Massachusetts is not a conservative state.
Right. And that's one of the reasons why certainly he looks at a state like New Hampshire as a potential launching pad for U.S. Senate campaign, that New Hampshire is a purple state and independents tend to dominate even in Republican primaries.
What do you think about this whole thing, Jeff Maccheroni, especially the response here in New Hampshire from both Republicans and Democrats? Jean Shaheen, for example, what she had to say about the possibility of running up against Scott Brown.
Well, she's been using it to fundraise. and I think there's been three or so emails from her just in the last week trying to raise some funds off the speculation that he might run. Which is certainly interesting. She must be taking it seriously, or at least seeing it as an opportunity to raise some money. But I would think his politics of as Kevin alluded to, his politics might kind of fit with New Hampshire. He's pretty moderate. While he was in the Senate, that is. So, you know, I could see where New Hampshire voters might be interested in him running. He's got a big name recognition. You know, we'll see. I think it's going to be fun to watch.
Right. And we'll definitely be following up on it on this program for sure. Another political story I wanted to ask all of you guys about, and maybe I'll start with you, Jeff. This is Executive Counselor Ray Burton saying that he won't run for re-election due to health reasons. Clearly with a heavy heart, Counselor Burton made this announcement. What was the reaction around the state to this? This was a big, big deal.
It was. I think it surprised some people, and obviously it's sad news. And I think he would have been going for his 19th term, I believe. So, he's just kind of like this beacon and this icon in the North Country. When you think the North Country, you think of Ray Burton, or at least I do. I think around the state, you know, I think people, regardless of political orientation, I think people have been upset and surprised and.
And sad.
Yeah.
You're right. Regardless of political orientation, that's a great point. And to follow up with you, Kevin Landrigan, Ray Burton was one of those, or is, he's still in office. He just won't run for re-election. One of those rare politicians who really seemed kind of partyless. I mean, he was a Republican, but no one talked about Ray Burton Republican. People talked about Ray Burton North Country.
No, that's true. And certainly represented over the years a district that would be more comfortable electing a Democrat. The district has been changed since 2010. It's even more Democratic than it was before. It's reasonable for Democrats in this state to think they have a real chance of replacing Ray Burton in 2014 with a Democrat, if it's the right Democrat. But I'm not sure, though, anybody's really going to be able to replace Ray Burton.
Frankly. Yeah, it's the end of an era, isn't it, Kevin?
It really is. He was referred to as the deputy governor. He's really the first executive counselor, I think, who approached the position as a full-time job. I mean, he worked as a Grafton County Commissioner. He taught part-time at college, but he devoted almost all of his waking moments to working there. He fundraised year-round. It was one of the things that made him almost impossible to defeat because he had such a broad network of supporters. He'd be somebody who could, you know, raise $50,000 a year and almost all of it under $200. He just had this huge reservoir of folks who would write small checks to him, most of whom were people that he had touched over the years, helped with one of those note cards that Josh was talking about at the break. I always felt as if he was someone who actually probably would be a perfect congressman because he was so good at constituent service. That's what members of Congress who are good do very well, and that's the reason members of Congress can stay for a long time is they respond to people's requests. It's something he never had an interest in doing. He didn't want to run for governor. He was particularly content with doing what he's always done, which is really deliver for that part of the state.
Deputy governor. I hadn't heard that, Kevin. That's great. What do you think,
yeah,
Dean?
Absolutely. You know, he was first elected in 1976, and then after a brief break, he's been in continuously since 1981, which is a pretty remarkable run. He is the longest-standing elected official in New Hampshire. Yeah, as Kevin and Jeff both alluded to, he really is kind of an old-school constituency service, all politics is local type of politician. And you know, one of the things I teach in my courses on American politics is all about the importance of constituency service for state and local politics. And he is kind of from an era where maybe politics was a little less nasty, a little less polarized. And as a result, he's been popular in that first district for many, many years. The next executive council from District 1 could be a Democrat. It would add to the Democratic majority if nothing else changes. But nonetheless, this really is kind of an end of an era. You don't see as many of these kind of long-serving politicians at the local level anymore.
Well, and Ray Burton will be honored. There's going to be a scenic overlook in the North Country, a new one in his name. And the accolades and tributes are already pouring in, even though this news just came out this week. We will talk a little bit more about politics after a short break. Gentlemen, I want to ask you about former Senate President Peter Bragdon and Nashua Mayor Donna Lee Lozo. Then we'll turn our attention to the Affordable Care Act, Common Core, and a couple other big stories. We'll also take your questions and comments, so you can join us at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. We'll be right back.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. Want to know what's going on this week at NHPR? An easy way for you to find out is when you sign up for our e-newsletter, This Week at NHPR, where you'll find out what the exchange, word of mouth, and our newsroom are planning for the week and get a behind-the-scenes look at the station. Click on the Connect menu to sign up for our e-newsletter at nhpr.org. New Hampshire weather, we have a wind advisory in effect for most of the state till late this evening. Cloudy with rain today. There is a slight chance of thunderstorms, which may produce some gusty winds. Warmer highs today, mid-60s to around 70 degrees. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Seacoast Orthopedics and Sports Medicine, orthopedics and team physicians for the UNH Wildcats, providing evaluations and surgical interventions for athletic injuries, sosmed.org. And Gibson's Bookstore in downtown Concord welcoming Archer Mayer November 9th, 2:30, signing a Three Can Keep a Secret, a Joe Gunter novel set during Tropical Storm Irene. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and we're covering some of the stories that made headlines this week. Lots of political headlines over the past few days that we've talked about. Also, controversy over new Common Core standards and continued debate here in New Hampshire over the Affordable Care Act. Let's take your questions and comments, too, about the stories that caught your attention this week. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And gentlemen, a couple more political stories I want to talk to you about. And Kevin Landrigan, real quickly to you, the Legislative Ethics Committee is investigating a complaint that former Senate President Peter Bragdon used his office for personal gain. What's this all about, Kevin?
Well, as you recall, Peter Bragdon became the CEO of the former local government center. He now runs what's called Health Trust. That's a risk pool that manages insurance, health insurance for cities and towns. State Representative Rick Waters, a Concord Democrat, has brought the complaint against Senator Bragdon that essentially alleges two violations. One, that actually taking the job from the LGC while he was Senate President amounts to an illegal gift. And the other allegation is that he used the position in order to benefit the LGC by appointing a very supportive LGC Senator, Jeanne Forrester, to a study committee that's looking at the future of risk pools. The chairman of the Ethics Commission, Marty Gross, made it clear that all we're doing is information gathering now, that we're not saying that violations have occurred. What's kind of interesting about what happens with complaints against legislators is that everything stays private until this point. So when you are the target of an ethics investigation, if you're a member of the legislature or a member of the staff, it's really in your best interest to put up a vigorous defense very early on. Because if you succeed in doing that and they dismiss the complaint, nothing ever becomes public about it. But the response by Senator Bragdon and his attorney, Russ Hilliard, was fairly dismissive to this complaint, and it left members of the committee with further questions. And once they have questions, that means we've got to do a preliminary investigation. And once we do that, then the complaint becomes public.
Well, here's another question that I have out of this. And you're right, Kevin. The head of the committee was very careful to say this is just information gathering. There's absolutely at this point no finding of wrongdoing. But it gets to a bigger issue, Dean, doesn't it? That, you know, state lawmakers are paid $100 a year. Unless you're wealthy or retired, you got to work. And there are these conflicts that come up. Why was Peter Bragdon's case considered a little bit different?
Well, in part because he was Senate president when he accepted the job. And if you remember back to when it was first announced that he would be taking the position, there was an outcry among Democrats that this was a conflict of interest. We hadn't quite gotten to the argument yet about it being an illegal gift, but there was the argument that this was a conflict of interest, and Republicans were uncharacteristically quiet on the issue. So sort of the momentum built with a number of editorials in different state papers that he needed to step down as Senate president. So he said he was going to step down, but not leave the Senate completely. And his argument, as you just said, was that it's a volunteer legislature. It's not a professional position. You have to make a living. And lots of members of the state legislature have jobs, and they recuse themselves from issues that directly pertain to their jobs. Now, his argument was, if I step down from being Senate, from being Senate president, then I can just simply recuse myself on any relevant issues. But now we've gotten into this other complaint, and you know, Bragdon's argument continues to be as long as I sort of recuse myself from any potential conflicts of interest, that is in keeping with the letter of the ethics law. So as Kevin said, this is informational at the moment, but it's interesting how this has sort of continued to be kind of a nagging problem for Peter Bragdon.
Our number again on the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in the exchange, and we're catching up on some of the top stories in the Granite State this week. The number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. Here's an email that came in from Wayne in Rumney. He says, to say that Ray Burton is the finest politician I've met in my life would not be an understatement. He has set the bar extraordinarily high for future councillors. More important, however, is that he has loyal friends like me in both parties who would turn our backs on political parties in a heartbeat on his behalf. His contribution will long be the gold standard for New Hampshire. I am proud to call him my friend. Wow. Wayne, thank you so much. That's beautifully written. It just gives you a sense, Jeff Maccheroni, of the deep affection and respect people have for Ray Burton.
Absolutely. He just is one of those people that, you know, and if you don't mind to share a quick story, I think it was one of the first assignments I ever had in a working for the Hippo up in Concord, and I didn't know who Ray Burton was. I didn't know who anyone was in New Hampshire, and I forget what the event was, but I was talking to him, or he came over to me, and I just remember thinking what a nice guy this was, and I had no idea who he was, and he handed me his card, and you know, at that point, what's the executive council?
But I think anyway, a lot of people would have that question.
but I was just struck by just what a great person.
Right, very low key, and yet very interested in using his influence to benefit his people. One more political story. This one is for you, Kevin Landrigan, of the Telegraph of Nashua. The mayor of your fair city, Donna Lee Lozo, is, I'm not sure how to put it, she's kind of in an argument with the police. And then today, the story got a little bit more serious. The attorney general is getting involved in an investigation of Mayor Lozo and her husband.
Yeah, it's really this kind of political infighting between a high elected official and the police department. It's something you sort of expect to see in Philadelphia or in Brooklyn politics, where
or Chicago,
right? Where, but essentially, Donnelly Lozo decided to go public with this complaint of hers that the National Police Department is essentially retaliated against her for taking pretty strong stances against police contracts and taking a hard line against the police union during collective bargaining negotiations. She revealed that the National Police has authorized secret wiretaps of her husband, David Lozo, who's a former ward alderman in Nashua, and also now a former bail commissioner. David Lozo has essentially issued a statement saying that one of the things they were investigating were allegations of bid rigging while Donnelly Lozo was working for Southern New Hampshire Services, which is an anti-poverty agency. Executive Counsel Deb Pignatelli has asked the Attorney General to investigate. As it turns out, Joe Foster, the Attorney General, has said, we've actually been monitoring this case. National Police reached out to us.
So it kind of kicks it up to a higher level, doesn't it?
It does. And it's possible that the county attorney, a county attorney might become involved. That this is always kind of a murky situation, which is that what do you do if you're a local police department and you have an elected official who's caught in some kind of criminal investigation? There is no rule book or playbook on how to respond. Some police departments have turned those investigations over to county attorneys, to attorneys general. Others have just been investigating the complaint like it was an ordinary citizen.
All right. Well, we'll leave that for now. I know the Telegraph of Nashua is obviously following that closely. I wanted to ask all of you about the Affordable Care Act, more deadlines approaching, New Hampshire and other states kind of wondering what the next step to take is, if I could put it that way, Dean. This week, two of New Hampshire's Democratic members of Congress joined Senator Jean Shaheen, calling for an extension of the enrollment period to sign up for insurance on healthcare.gov. Just put this in the bigger picture for us, Dean, these statements by Carol Shea Porter and Anne McLean Custer joining Jean Shaheen.
Right. Well, this all really gets back to kind of the overall problematic initial implementation of the Affordable Care Act. You remember a little while ago, the Obama administration delayed the employer mandate for insurance coverage. And now the issue is in the marketplace for individuals. There have been a lot of problems with their website. It's been well documented and covered exhaustively in the news. Republicans have been calling for a delay in the individual mandate, just like the delay in the employer mandate, for a year. The Obama administration does not want to do that. They see that as a slippery slope to stalling the Affordable Care Act. But we've seen in recent weeks Democratic Senator Jean Shaheen writing a letter to the administration, not asking for a delay of the mandate, but for asking for an extension of the March 31st deadline to give people more time to sign up because of the web problems. And now, more recently, two congresswomen from New Hampshire, Carol Shea Porter and Annie Custer, have also joined in on that call, not for a delay in the individual mandate, but for an extension of that March 31st deadline. The administration's response has essentially been, you know, we're working on fixing the website. It should be much better by the end of November. There's no reason to rush to an extension of the deadline at this point. If in the winter it turns out there are still problems, then we will consider it at that time. But, you know, at this point, Republicans and Democrats are both calling for some sort of accountability and potentially an extension of the deadline. So, for a month ago, it would have been kind of an interesting move by a Democratic member of Congress to say this to the Obama administration. Now, I think lots of Democrats feel this way, and it's just sort of everybody kind of piling on at this point.
Yeah, Jeff, what does this mean that New Hampshire's two Democrats, again, in Congress, Jean Shaheen got the ball rolling last week. What does it say that Custer and Carol Shea Porter have now jumped on this as well?
Well, they seem to be, somewhat obviously, following following Shaheen's lead, which, that she can kind of play that middle ground as well as anybody. So following her lead's probably not a bad move, you know, going into an election year next year. So, you know, and I just kind of echoing what Dean said, it's just this rollout has just been so problematic with the website that it's almost like they don't have much of a choice but to raise some concerns with it. So
right.
I think that's probably where they're coming from.
Well, and I wanted to ask all of you about another big piece of the law, and that's Medicaid expansion. Under more scrutiny this month with a special session of the New Hampshire legislature for 2 weeks, wow, from November 7th to the 21st, on whether New Hampshire should join this expansion or not. Dean, just real quick to you, and then I want to ask Kevin something else. New Hampshire, Dean, is one of the last states to decide, almost the last state to decide. There may be a couple other outliers. Why is that?
Right. Well,
everybody else has either jumped in one lake or the other pretty much at this point.
Right. Well, I think it gets back to sort of a debate within the state legislature about whether or not to expand Medicaid. You know, you remember that when the Supreme Court upheld the Affordable Care Act, they did say, however, that states, individual states, should be allowed to decide whether or not to expand Medicaid. And that essentially means taking $2.5 billion over 3 years from the federal government, and then they'll fund it at 90% for a set number of years, and then eventually it'll tail off. And the big debate within the state has been whether or not to do that, whether or not this is going to turn into some unfunded mandate that's going to cost New Hampshire millions of dollars in the end once the funding tapers off. So we've had this real debate within the state legislature about whether or not to do this. And so it's just taken a while. And you know, a lot of states have decided to take the money. I think at least half of the states. Others have decided not to take the money. And we're one of a handful who are still sort of figuring this out. Now, you can decide to accept that money in any quarter. So there's not like there's a December 31st deadline. They could, in theory, decide to accept it in the winter or in the spring.
But you get but we're less gonna have this, the longer you
yeah,
wait.
Yeah, exactly. And so we're going to have this special session that I'm sure Kevin will talk about. To vote on whether or not to do this.
Yeah, so Kevin, a couple weeks ago, Norma Love, the Associated Press, talked about this, and she said, by the time that session gets started, a lot of the decision-making has already happened. So what happens in advance of this big session on this big, big issue, Medicaid expansion? What's happening right now?
Well, a commission that studied expansion came out with a report and made some recommendations to expand Medicaid. One of the major tweaks they made to the original proposal was basically to allow people who are on Medicaid, who have access to private insurance, to continue to be on private insurance and have Medicaid as a benefit wrap around that proposal. Right, for the past week and a half now, Governor Maggie Hassan and her team have been meeting behind closed doors with Senate President Chuck Morse, the new Senate President who replaced Peter Bragdon. The 13 Republicans really hold the key here to whether Medicaid expansion really passes or not. And Senator Morse feels pretty strongly that private insurance needs to be the default rather than the payer of last resort. He really would like to see as many of these folks put into private insurance and have federal grants support them. That's what we're negotiating now. We'll meet, the legislature meets next Thursday to essentially admit a bill. That's why the next week is really critical, that if there's going to be a compromise, we're going to probably see it by Wednesday night. If there isn't going to be a compromise, we're going to have a pretty partisan, knockdown, drag-out session that may not result in any proposal at all passing.
One last quick question on this for you, Jeff. So already groups, you know, in favor and against this are getting together, making their voices heard. Who got together this week in a news conference in anticipation of this special session coming out and making arguments against Medicaid expansion? What was that about?
Sure. I think it was Americans for Prosperity. And it seems like there's Dean had alluded to the financial, the federal money coming in if they do expand Medicaid. And there seems to be some concern that, well, those benefits might seem good and they might be good, but the federal government isn't always so good at keeping promises. So there seems to be this issue where, okay, if we sign up, there's kind of no turning back, but there's concern that down the road, maybe the federal government won't be offering up as much money as they say they will.
Yeah, and Dean, go ahead.
Yeah, it's interesting. It was the Americans for Prosperity, and also I think the Republican Liberty Caucus was there. You know, the arguments we heard were pretty much the ones we've heard all along about an unfunded mandate and that the program needs to be reformed, not expanded. But the interesting thing that came out of the conference for me was sort of a fairly direct threat that Republicans in the Senate, in the state Senate, who support Medicaid expansion may pay a price electorally and be challenged by more conservative opponents primaried in the next election. So that was interesting news to hear that threat made directly. The actual criticisms we've sort of been hearing for a while now.
I see what you're saying. So on the substance, we've heard that before, but this was sort of a political shot across
exactly,
the bow.
Exactly.
All right. Again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Lots of stories to catch up on our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. Kevin Landrigan, just at the end of the week, on Thursday, I think, the New Hampshire Center for Public Policy Studies, in conjunction with the Business and Industry Association, released something called an economic dashboard. Now, what's the purpose of this, Kevin?
Yeah, the New Hampshire Center, which essentially is an independent think tank here, has been developing these kind of metrics of how states rank. It's a pretty comprehensive list. There's 50 different indicators of it. They were doing this job essentially for the Business and Industry Association that later this fall will come out with its economic strategic plan that will probably make a number of recommendations and public policies to make New Hampshire more competitive. What was interesting about the report was that it essentially showed what we already knew New Hampshire was strong at. Very high level of education, very low state and local tax burden, high graduation rate from high school, low rate of poverty, but ranked very badly in a number of areas that look to our economic future. If you look at student debt, we're 50th. If healthcare costs, we're 48th. Energy costs, we're 47th. The drop in the population of folks between 35 and 44 was the third worst in the country. Those are really bad indicators for New Hampshire going forward. If you're trying to attract young people not only to be educated here but to stay here and get some of the good jobs of tomorrow, that's a real problem.
Yeah, and that's why the BIA was interested in getting this data to kind of look at where we're strong, where we're not so strong, especially those future indicators not looking so great, Kevin.
Right.
All right. We will follow up after a short break, and we'll take your calls at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. We'll be right back.
This is NHPR 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. Apologies from the Obama administration over rollout of the Affordable Care Act website. Then international inspectors meet their deadline for ridding Syria of chemical weapons. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and support also comes to us from the Clean Bedroom Organic Mattress and Bedding Showroom in Kittery, Maine, helping you create eco-friendly sleep environments, also on the web at thecleanbedroom.com. And the Rotary Club of Concord presenting Magic of Movies and Television November 1st through the 3rd at Concord City Audi, with tunes performed by Rotarians and Friends. ConcordNHRotary.org. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, tomorrow in The Exchange, the pushback on the new Common Core Education Standards. That's Monday on The Exchange. You can email us before the program at exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And again, join us Monday morning live at 9 for a conversation about the Common Core. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. And you can join our conversation now with your thoughts, questions, comments about some of the headlines that we've been following. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange. And actually, gentlemen, I did want to open up this segment talking a little bit with you now about Common Core. As I said, we'll be looking at it more on Monday. And Jeff, to you first, please. New school standards adopted in 2010 with little public attention. Now, though, Jeff, it seems like there are bills being filed to pull the plug on this effort. There's some pushback at the community level in a couple cities and towns. There was a news conference or a meeting this week about Common Core just to get more information out there. What's going on, Jeff?
Sure. Well, yeah, as you'd mentioned, Common Core was the state passed Common Core in 2010, and that's the federal education standards that kind of set the same standards for everybody, basically. So now you're kind of starting to see a little bit of an uproar from those opposed because they're thinking it's taking away local control, even though communities do have the option to they don't have to adopt them, but they will be tested on them. I think it's by 2015. So you are starting to hear some groups that are concerned that that again the local control is lacking in this, in that, and there are I think three bills or so that are tied to this. Some would repeal it, or one would repeal it. I think another would kind of push it back a little bit. But there's some concern that the legislative committee is only hearing from those who are in favor of the Common Core, so they're not getting the a balanced view on it anyway.
Yeah, Kevin, love your thoughts on this too. Again, adopted a couple of years ago, nobody really paid attention, and now some folks, and let's just say this is not statewide, but in some communities, they're saying, "Whoa, we're not sure if we want this or not."
Yeah, I think that this issue is has always been a difficult one at the local level, whether it, as we saw with the National Education Assessment Test, when under former President George W. Bush, there were a lot of conservatives in his own Republican Party in New Hampshire who were very unhappy with him about requiring these tests. And they see Common Core, many of these folks, in the same vein. As Jeff said, losing local control, taking time away from what folks think should be done in classroom in order to teach to these standards and to eventually pass these tests, and many folks at the local level see it as a unfunded mandate. Even folks who support Common Core, many of them have some concerns about how it is going to be implemented. Teachers want to know, are we going to have enough time in the classroom to get what we want done, and also to teach this curriculum? And are local teachers going to get financial support for developing and adhering to Common Core? Are they going to get training and professional development support from the federal government to do that?
Boy, listening to you talk, Kevin, I feel like we're having the same conversation that we had, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago about No Child Left Behind. But there is a key difference here. No Child Left Behind was a federal law, a federal mandate. Common Core comes from the states. It was germinated by state education officials, voluntarily adopted state by state by state. So it's different that way, but the concerns are the same.
It's true, and you're right. It and certainly there has been strong support, frankly, across the ideological spectrum in the past for this notion that that we need to get back to a strong common curriculum to teach proficiency.
If there's too much variety from state to state, that
exactly.
We're not competing well internationally.
Right. And like everything, it's once you start to implement it, a lot of folks get nervous about how it's going to affect their pocketbook and maybe their children.
Let's take some calls. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Jonathan's waiting in Manchester. Hi, Jonathan. Thanks for calling in. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning, Laura.
Morning.
Well, I just thought it was fascinating. You switched from one subject to another, which was first the not accepting of the Medicaid expansion, and then you switched to reasons. The subject matter was why young people aren't coming to the state, what's going to attract young people to the state. And if you don't think young people are concerned about not accepting the Medicaid expansion, I live downtown Manchester. I'm a 10th generation New Hampshire guy, just moved back here after having a career in New York City. And I talk to young people, there's cafes and everything downtown here now, finally. And people are shocked that the GOP and the state are holding such a Tea Party line on this, not accepting it. That, you know, we've got people, same goes for Scott Brown, you know, people are not pleased about that sort of blind march to not accept these things and to not think about the future. And New Hampshire's had a problem with that for a long time, with the talent of the state leaving and not coming back.
And you're tying that to the push against Medicaid expansion, Jonathan?
I think people are talking about how backward it is thinking to not do that. Even a right-wing governor like Jan Brewer fought to get that money. New Hampshire is a poor state. There's a lot of people in desperate need. And this Medicare expansion, that is going to help people if they take it. Medicaid expansion, that will help people. And it's very crazy to make it such a political point when Medicaid has never not been unfunded. I don't think there's a history where the government has ever pulled Medicaid money from states and not funded it. So this idea that, it's not going to be funded or there's a slippery slope. Well, guess what? Why not readdress it? The problem when that comes to term.
All right. And Jonathan, I'm going to jump in just because I want to hear from Dean Spiliotis. Thank you very much for calling in, Jonathan. And what do you think, Dean, making the connection between not accepting Medicaid, that story, to this report that says young folks aren't coming to New Hampshire?
Now, I personally haven't seen any survey data on this where you can actually look at different age cohorts. It sounds like Jonathan has had some anecdotal conversations. It's certainly a possibility. I personally have not had those conversations with my students, but perhaps I just haven't asked the question as directly as I should. But I think what's so important about Jonathan's comments, and clearly you can hear the passion in his voice, is I think there's general agreement that the state has a problem keeping young people here. But the political aspect of it is exactly what Jonathan was getting at. There's real disagreement about how you shape the community, how you shape the state to make it a desirable place for young people to live. Is it a function of the state and federal government providing certain types of benefits and assistance in order to help people get on their feet? Or is it a function of, you know, sort of private sector conditions and having types of or lack of either types of regulations or limited regulations so that industry and jobs can thrive? And that's fundamentally an ideological debate. So, yeah, I'm sure for some portion of the younger demographic, the Medicaid may be an issue. But there are also others who are going to say it's a function of sort of a lack of business opportunity.
And Jonathan's right. There are people in need. He's not quite right, Kevin, when he says New Hampshire's a poor state. We're actually among the top 10 wealthiest states per capita in the nation.
Yeah, we are. And that's why for the rest of our Medicaid population now, we only get 50% support. It's the lowest level of support of any state in the country. There's about 15 states that are at that 50% level, and we are. I was more struck by a comment that Jonathan made with regard to being glad there were cafes downtown. Going back to economic
in Manchester.
In Manchester, going back to economic dashboard study, what was also interesting about that study essentially was that it essentially concludes that that a lot of New Hampshire's problem can't be easily solved by changes in public policy. And one of the problems New Hampshire has, and that is clear, is that its urban areas aren't considered hotbeds for young people to congregate. What the authors have seen in many cities across the country that have dynamic 21st century economies, places like Austin, Texas, Provo, Utah, even Bozeman, Montana, they all have a buzz about them in the community. They're vibrant. There's a lot of nightlife. There's a lot of things going on that attract young people there to visit and eventually say, hey, this is a place I might like to live. And Jonathan's expression is one thing certainly the folks doing this study have heard a lot of.
All right. Well, Jonathan, it's good to hear from you, and we're glad you came back. Let's take another call. This is Cole in Concord. Hi, Cole. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much. I was struck when I heard, how poorly New Hampshire is doing in terms of student debt. I think that's a national issue that eventually we're going to have to really address to the level of which I think it impacts our economy. When you think about stimulating the economy, having young professionals come out and have the financial ability to be able to spend and stimulate from their end is fairly limited when such a heavy debt is put on their shoulders. And just curious to see what you guys think about that and what we are doing to try to address that here locally.
Yeah, thanks a lot for the call, Cole. And Jeff Maccheroni, he's right. New Hampshire college graduates graduate with the highest debt burden in the nation. We keep bouncing between highest and second highest. Not much of an honor. What do you think about Cole's point? Thanks a lot, Cole, for calling.
It's a great point. I think students on average graduate with about $32,000 or $34,000 in debt. And that's, I believe, students graduating from New Hampshire colleges. And so how long is that going to take to pay off, and what's the burden for these people? So the reality is they're not buying houses as quickly. They're living at their parents' houses for longer. It's taking them longer to get their professional life started and to get to a point where they're more comfortable. They may go elsewhere. And I think it's got impacts kind of across the board, because then, if you have high student debt, you may just go to college somewhere else, and then maybe you'll live somewhere else. So I mean, there's just so many ways that is not a good thing.
Yeah, and you don't have the money to buy that first house, and if you're not buying the house, maybe you're not buying the carpet or the couch or the curtains and all those other things.
Absolutely.
So there's ripple effects. Thanks a lot for that question, Cole, and that's a story that we've followed up a lot on here in the Exchange, and will for sure be following up on in the future. So thank you. Let's take one more if we could. This is Larry waiting in Berlin. Hey, Larry, thanks for hanging on. You're on the air.
Morning, Laura.
Morning. Thanks for waiting.
Well, thanks. Just a quick personal anecdote that may give some insight into Ray Burton's popularity. And I don't want to question his sincerity, okay? But I'm a retired firefighter, and a number of years ago I saw Ray Burton at some function. It may have been a convention or something like that, you know, Ray Burton would show up. Whenever there was more than 50 people gathered, Ray Burton would appear. And then a number of years later, I met him again somewhere, maybe on Main Street or something like that. And I walked up, hi, Ray, how are you? And he looked at me and he said, I'm fine. It's so nice to see you again. How are things going at the fire department?
Wow, so he remembered.
Well, after reflecting upon it, he probably had no idea who I was. He probably didn't remember what fire department I was from, but he remembered seeing me dressed up in a firefighting dress uniform, and that's all he needed to make me feel like I was important, like Ray Burton cared about me. Ray Burton cared about how things were going in my hometown and how things were going with me, and I don't doubt his sincerity, because I'm sure he did. But that was just the kind of guy that Ray was. He made you feel like he was there for you. He was interested in you. And, if there was such a thing as king, we probably would have elected him for that. Okay?
Larry, thank you so much for sharing that story. And this gets to something I heard about what it takes to be a successful politician, Dean Spiliotis. Sure. And one of those things is a really good memory.
Yeah, that's what Larry's talking about there is what in the business we call a retail skill, retail politics skill, the ability to connect with voters one-on-one using I've seen it myself in talking to politicians over the year, how they manage to use just sort of incidental things in the environment or in the conversation to make you feel like you're important. And that's a skill. Some people can learn it. Some people it's natural. Those who don't have it typically don't stay in office all that long.
All right. Well, Larry, it's great to hear from you. Thanks again for the call. And all of you, we have just about a minute and a half left. And I did want to know, Kevin, I'll start with you. What stories you're going to be following this coming week? I think I can guess one of them is that special session on Medicaid expansion.
Yeah, to be sure, after I catch up on my sleep from watching the Red Sox win the World Series over the weekend.
That's right. We didn't talk about that yet.
That certainly dominated this week and was a great development for all of us fans that love Boston. I'm going to be following special elections next week at the local level. There's some pretty interesting ones, certainly in Manchester and Jeff's wheelhouse. Mayor Ted Gatsis has a pretty strong challenge from Patrick Arnold. It'll be fascinating to see how that race comes out. There's a special election in Nashua for a House seat between two very, very hardworking people, the Democrat Latha Manjapudi and the Republican Peter Silva, a former House Majority Leader. I think both those elections could tell us something about what 2014 is going to look like.
Yeah, real interesting. And there are some interesting races in Concord for mayor and lots of city council races. How about you, Jeff Matroni?
Oh, well, definitely the mayoral race in Manchester. That's that's been very interesting, maybe somewhat surprisingly so. So I'll definitely be staying tuned in on that as well.
What else, Jeff? I know sometimes the Hippo does these sort of big, in-depth pieces. For one time you guys did one on transportation, another time you guys did one on education. What other sort of big thinky pieces are you guys working
on? Sure. I'm working on a piece on a timely topic, I think, from Cole's call on housing. I mean, it ties into the student debt. And how, while we've seen home prices and the median home prices and home sales rebound, housing production hasn't rebounded yet, which is normal. But that's something to watch. That's
Absolutely.
Something we'll be looking at.
Yeah, Dean, how about you?
The Medicaid, the special session on expansion of Medicaid is going to kick in. I'm going to be watching that. But it continues to be fascinating to me to watch our Democratic members of Congress deal with this very uncomfortable situation of the problematic rollout of Obamacare. So I'll be watching all of them as well.
Well, and an email came in just in the last couple minutes from Brad, who says, please be careful. Ray is being spoken of in the past tense. He's still with us. Absolutely, Brad. We recognize that. We said earlier that he's not running for re-election. I think some of the reflections we've heard this hour, though, are from people who are sad to see Mr. Burton step down. But you're absolutely right, Brad. So thanks for that email. Here on The Exchange, we're going to be doing some timely shows next week. An update on the Common Core controversy. We're going to devote a whole hour to that on Monday. And later in the week, we're going to be looking at the coming debate over Social Security. The legislative director for AERP from the national office is coming up to New Hampshire. We'll have him along with the Concord Coalition, the Deficit Hawk Group, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. So lots of stuff coming up in The Exchange next week as well. Guys, this has been great. Thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks, Laura.
Kevin Landrigan, political reporter for the Telegraph of Nashua, along with Jeff Maccheroni, staff writer at the Hippo Press, and Dean Spiliotis, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
Next week on The Exchange, we begin with controversy over Common Core. Just as these new standards for public schools are being put in place, there's pushback in some communities. Then, with games like tag and dodgeball being banned on some playgrounds, we ask, are kids today overprotected? And later, Social Security in the spotlight as the next round of federal budget negotiations begins. Send us your thoughts by email, Facebook, and join us all next week for The Exchange, every morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show is next at 10 o'clock on NHPR, where support comes from UR members and from Moulton Farm and Market in Meredith, accepting orders until November 21st for fresh, local, free-range turkeys for your Thanksgiving table. Details at MouldonFarm.com. And the Colonial Theater in Keene presenting World Blues, a celebration of the global influence of American blues featuring Taj Mahal, Friday, November 8th. Tickets at thecolonial.org.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio. WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua,
88.3. WEVH, Hanover,
91.3. WEVN, Keene, 90.7. WEVC, Gorham,
107.1. WEVJ, Jackson,
99.5. WEVF, Colebrook,
90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton,
91.9. And online at nhpr.org.
Good morning, it's 10 o'clock.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. Lawmakers on Capitol Hill blasted administration officials for the troubled launch of the Affordable Care Act. Health and Human Services Secretary Sebelius said, blame me for the website's flaws. Senate Republicans blocked two white